Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90, exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.
When you golf in Missouri, the courses are so close, you'll spend more time on the fairway than the freeway. Reserve a tee time at the Regal Osage National, designed by the king himself, Arnold Palmer. Take a cart ride on the wild side in the breathtaking surrounds of Payne's Valley, designed by Tiger Woods. And after the back nine, there's still world-class dining and distilleries, shops and spas, museums and more. Find your new golf MO in Missouri. Start planning your golf getaway at visitmo.com.
Everyone, welcome back to another episode of Friends from Work, a podcast about all things in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and it's hosted by me, Kyle, and my longtime friend, Robbie.
So today we have another special interview for you guys, and this is one that I personally have been hoping to do for a while here. We have a writer today that comes from Austin, where I live, and he's someone that I've followed a lot over the past couple of years and that I've become a big fan of. He wrote a 2018 comic called Rise of the Black Panther that came out sort of in the midst of the Ta-Nehisi Coates Black Panther run that's critically acclaimed, and it's a really, really beautifully written comic, and I don't say that lightly because I'm pretty picky when it comes to writing in particular with this stuff, and it's just masterfully done. It came out the same year as the Black Panther film, and as we talk about in this interview, kind of has a lot of synergy with that film. They both deal with kind of the sort of contradictions inherent in the Wakandan project and identity and this idea of opening yourself up to the world and what it means to be an African nation that was never colonized. And it just deals with all, if you're a fan of the Marvel Comics universe, it goes into all sorts of kind of deep Black Panther mythology, gold nuggets. And I think you'll really enjoy it. You have everything from Captain America and the Winter Soldier to Namor and Storm and Luke Cage and just all sorts of really fun stuff that also serves to be a perfect intro point for you if you've never read a Black Panther comic or a comic at all. I know often folks are looking for an end there. So I love the chance to sit down with Evan for that reason.
But also, I love the chance to sit down with Evan because he was one of the creators and the writers of the Miles Morales video game. So the game that we have an episode reviewing, he was a part of making that, which is just so much fun. And truly, I mean this, it was one of my favorite games to play this year. As you know, Robbie and I love that game, and we love the original Spider-Man PS4 game.
Yes.
They're both unbelievable, top tier. And so to get a chance to talk with him about writing that and creating it was so much fun. So I think you guys are going to enjoy it. Without further ado, here is Evan Narcisse.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Friends from Work. Today is a very special episode because today we are speaking with a writer that I'm a huge fan of. I've been looking to sit down with him for a long time. He writes about all sorts of pop culture stuff from video games to television to comics and beyond. He himself has written the Rise of the Black Panther comic, which came out in 2018. And more recently, and especially exciting for my co-host here, the Spider-Man Miles Morales.
Let's go.
PS5 and PS4 game. So welcome to Friends from Work, Evan Narcisse.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for being here. I have to say, first off, and apologies to folks that are listening on the, to this via audio and aren't seeing the video, but you've got the poster there of Rise of the Black Panther behind you. And I had to bring
this year, mostly because I had to show you, I have this little Wakanda Forever Evan Narcisse signature there.
Where was that?
So that was at Austin Books and Comics.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so we hail from the same city here. Actually, to kind of go a little bit further in the creepiness here, I actually saw you introduce, the first time I saw Black Panther was at the Mueller Alamo, yep. And you introduced it there. So
Yeah. That was fun. That was a really amazing night. I was honored I got asked to do it. You know, I'm honored that I get to be part of this character's legacy, even in a little way. It's been a fun ride and probably has changed my life. Mm. Definitely. There's no probably that. About it, but yeah.
And Robbie, I didn't know that, so I love that so much. You have creepy background stalker history. I love
yeah,
it.
Yeah, you
know. It's all good. Always you, just you and a few other 100 people. It's
yeah. yeah.
You know, I love in the preface to that comic, you talk about how much you were a fan of the character, obviously, and how the Christopher Priest run was really one of the things that inspired that book. What I think is so fascinating reading that is there seems to be a lot of synergy between some of the work that you were doing in Rise of the Black Panther and some of what the Black Panther film did. Yeah. And, you know, some of that makes sense because they're both origin stories. And, you know, they came out the same year. But I was curious, how much were you aware of what Ryan Coogler was doing with the film and how much of a, you know, sort of collaboration artistically did you feel like that was?
I knew nothing about what Ryan was doing and the people who made the movie were doing. I knew nothing, absolutely nothing. To the point where, you know, I was writing this, like, first meeting with Marvel happened like in 2016. And then I was writing it through 2017 and the whole while, you know, not knowing anything about the movie. I think it was Comic-Con 2017 where they showed the first footage, in Hall H, or was it the first trailer? Anyway, one of the early trailers was, a scene of T'Challa in the UN. And, you know, originally in my first kind of draft of the outline, I wanted to open with T'Challa at the UN. And, I saw that trailer. I was like, I can't do that. You know, people are thinking I'm just cribbing off the movie. So went back to the drawing board, kind of find a different way to kind of approach the same idea, which kind of culminates at the end of issue 3 of Rise of the Black Panther. But like, yeah, I didn't know anything what they were doing. So, you know, I'm lucky enough to get to go to the premiere of the movie in January of 2018. And I see the movie. I'm like, oh, we're not only were we both using Killmonger as the primary antagonist, you know, it was a very similar take, you know, like, which is that here's a Wakandan, you know, kind of stranded by circumstance outside of the country of his birth, which he never really got to know. And that, you know, framing psychologically puts him in a place where he feels like he wants to be the avatar of like a Wakandan supremacy. And he feels like they need to conquer the world and he's the guy to do it to help them to lead them through that. I mean, I was shocked at how similar the takes were. but I think, you know, like we can talk about like the zeitgeist or collective subconscious or whatever surrounding like the Black Panther mythos. But I think, you know, like Joe Robert Cole, who co-wrote the screenplay with Ryan, I think, you know, all our heads were probably in the same place, which is like, you know, the Black Panther is a character that if you're a member of like the Black diaspora, you can use that character's mythology to investigate what it means to like, okay, only know parts of your history, you know, like, and Killmonger is a great character to do that through. So I think that's why we wound up in the same place. But, you know, to wrap up my very long answer to your question, I knew nothing, you know, to the point where like, you know, issue 3 of the series, like is all about the Winter Soldier being deployed as a spy to try and infiltrate Wakanda. And, you know, of course, Bucky shows up in the post-credits scene and I didn't know that either.
Oh yeah.
So that's so wild.
So, you know, I think it's just a coincidence. Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that is crazy, because I was reading it. I thought, well, surely he's working some of these elements in intentionally. Like the Bucky thing specifically. That's crazy.
Yeah. So, you know, I knew nothing about what the movie plan was. So, you know, I'm happy that there is some synergy there, and I'm happy that the series works kind of as an introductory text that, you know, also features a lot of the same characters from the movie. But I'm also happy that it stands alone as its own story, you know, one of the things I really appreciated being able to do was to use all these toys, which at the time, you know, couldn't even imagine being in a Marvel movie. Right. So, you know, I think I'm pretty sure, well, I definitely wrote it before the Fox merger. You know, you couldn't even think about, you know, Fox characters that Marvel characters that Fox had the rights to, like the Fantastic Four. You couldn't even, you know, imagine them being in a Black Panther movie. Right.
Right.
But now you can. But I didn't have those same kind of limitations, you know, in the Marvel Comics universe. So I was able to, you know, adhere to the kind of classic version of T'Challa's first appearance, where, you know, he lures a Fantastic Four to Wakanda and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So I can, you know, I could use Namor. I could use all these other characters that were in the series. So I was really happy about that. So I'm glad that, you know, the two texts can talk to each other, but also have their own distinct textures that make them appealing in their own right. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I was rereading it ahead of today, and you're right. It really does stand on its own, even within the comic mythos, in a way that I really appreciate, because I think often whenever I've come to a Black Panther run, it always feels like I'm sort of missing something. You know, it always feels like I'm dropping into the middle, even, you know, as great as so many of them are, it feels like I often need to, you know, go online and do some research and kind of orient myself. And I thought that this in so many ways was the Black Panther story I had always wanted as a comic reader. Like, I thought it was so interesting, you know, I'm a big fan of what Hickman did with Black Panther and his Avengers. And I thought it was really interesting how you worked. You went back to some of the really classic stuff, even from the 60s, obviously, but then reworked in all these elements from these other great eras of the Black Panther so organically.
I mean, that was part of my own personal mandate for myself. You know, like, Marvel pretty much let me do what I want. You know, obviously, there was a desire to kind of center the characters that were going to be in the movie that I knew about. But that was always part of the plan personally. So I was always going to figure out Shuri, and I was always going to use Killmonger. But, you know, part of my own personal mandate to myself was, okay, you love this character. He's gone through all these wildly different iterations, right? You've got like the crazy, like, science fiction heavy aspect of the Kirby run from the 70s. You know, you've got the Lee and Kirby run from Fantastic Four, where, you know, he shows up, he's kind of sneaky, you know, all the kind of establishing foundational ideas of the character. You've got Don McGregor, of course, that classic Jungle Action run, which was drawn a lot by Billy Graham and some Rich Buckler in there too. But, like, you know, he turns T'Challa. That's the first real focus on Wakanda's internal statecraft, right? Like, how the politics work and what people inside the country think of him. And you know, this is the first place Killmonger shows up. So his T'Challa was very, like, compassionate and philosophical. You know, then you get, like, there's a Peter Milligan story from the 80s that I kind of sort of nodded at. You know, that's the place, first place where some of the other countries around Wakanda get focused on. And that's something that Ta-Nehisi later expanded on in his run. But, you know, so part of the goal with Rise was, all right, how can I make all these different things talk to each other and feel cohesive, right? You know, like, there's the character of Jakara that Kirby created and, you know, is sort of kind of villain of the month, right? You know, but he's T'Challa's half-brother. I'm like, well, can I find a way to make this work? You know, like, I knew one of the things I wanted to do in Rise of the Black Panther was tell a story about family, right? And that's always been a hallmark of Black Panther stories, Reginald Hudlin expanded his family in significant ways with his uncle Cyan, who was the regent, you know, and I used him in Rise. So like, how can I get all these different things to talk to each other and make it seem like it all has always existed that way? One of the things I like to point out is that, you know, in the priest run, T'Challa was still an only child, right? So, you know, when he's broody and kind of strategic and manipulative and Machiavellian, like, it makes sense. Like, yeah, he's an only child. The whole weight of this, like, kind of legacy is on his shoulders. But then Reginald Hudlin introduces Shuri, you know, a couple of years later. And my thinking was, well, T'Challa's, you know, he can still have gone through that moment canonically, but like, off to the side, Shuri would have been like, you know, oh my God, can you stop sulking? Like, come on already. Like, like, and again, I landed there in terms of thinking about like what a sibling rivalry was, like a loving kind of poke fun at your sibling kind of deal might have been. And you know, Ryan and Joe for the movie wound up in the same place. So, you know, it feels good to know that like there's these kind of core notions of these characters that are so well designed, in my opinion, that they manage to rise to the surface whenever like, you know, different creators are thinking of them, you know? That was part of the goal, was to like, you know, okay, you know what? Hunter, the White Wolf, let's say he was there from the very beginning, right? Like, let's say like he's a character that Priest added in his run, but let's say he was there from before even T'Challa was born. Like, how would that affect, like, what would the discourse about that be in Wakandan politics, you know? Like, so I had a couple of scenes where like people of the tribal council were like, yeah, you know, T'Chaka adopted this little white kid and I don't know what that's about. but then we see what that's about, you know? I make a point of saying, okay, there's a utility for this, you know, secretive African nation to have a white envoy that they can send out to the world to do stuff that they can't be caught doing. So that was part of what the thinking was for me in kind of reconsidering and trying to recontextualize all the different Black Panther runs that had preceded Rise.
I really love the work that you did with the White Wolf there. And we actually just talking about Falcon Winter Soldier and the way that that term has been used somewhat to refer to Bucky Barnes in the MCU.
Yeah.
And we sort of talked about how, you know, that series ends with the title card changing from Falcon Winter Soldier to Captain America and Winter Soldier. And there was a lot of folks, a lot of listeners reach out, sort of wishing that it had changed to Captain America and the White Wolf. And that's one of those things where I'm sort of, it does seem like maybe that moniker is off the table now, but I do like the idea of saving a space for that Hunter character, rather than kind of giving that wholesale over to the Bucky character, because I think the angle that you took there seems like it could bear a lot of fruit in like future installments.
You know, nobody's asked me. I'm not like officially connected to the Marvel cinematic universe in any way, but you know, I watched the show and, you know, I had similar thoughts probably to some of your listeners about that title. And, you know, one of the places I landed was, you know, this could be an inherited title, you know, like this could be like, or it could be a nickname, you know, like it's like, oh, okay. Like that's my play cousin, you know, like, you know, when you call somebody your cousin, at least within Black communities, you call somebody your cousin when you're not actually related to them. And it's like, yeah, that's the White Wolf, you know, like he's cool, you know, like he's kind of sort of part of the family. And you know, it could be as informal or as formal as, you know, the folks making the decisions there want to make it, you know. But I think again, it's kind of a shorthand for like, okay, your inner circle, not all the way inner circle, not necessarily royal court inner circle, but like, you know, you're cool, we vetted you, the whole fixing your mind and your arm thing. Like, so yeah, you know, it just feels like a parasocial relationship to like Wakandan culture that, you know, they definitely leaned on in the show. And I think you can use that nickname to communicate the idea that Bucky has a certain amount of respect and familiarity granted to him by the Wakandans who know him. You know, so I think, you know, it doesn't have to mean the exact same thing as it does in the comics.
Right.
But it can signify that the character has a special meaning to these people. When he acts right, when he doesn't act right, he gets his arm taken off.
Yeah, right. Right. Failsafe built in. Yeah.
That's a good point. I was curious, and maybe this is sort of a transition for us, as we're talking about kind of the way that you were able to loop in all of this Black Panther history, and there's so much of it. And I do feel like Black Panther is sort of like Daredevil in that he's been a consistently well-written character. And so there's a lot of great stuff to pull from there. But I was curious, you know, thinking about Rise of the Black Panther and thinking about the Miles Morales game, how is it different to write a character that's been around, you know, for what, 60 years, as opposed to, and one that, you know, has meant a lot for a long time to like the Black community of comic book fans, as opposed to a character that's relatively, you know, new to the scene. I think 2011?
I think it was 2011.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, and Evan, as we transition to that too, I don't understand this, and I'm sure our listeners don't, but just can you talk to us a little bit how writing a character for a video game differs from just on paper?
Yeah, okay, so to touch on both of those, Robbie, I'll start with yours first. Like, you know, obviously the reservoir of publishing history for a character like Black Panther is much deeper, right? And, you know, again, part of the my goal for writing Rise of Black Panther was to kind of interrogate that, like complicate it. You know, like one of the things I'm proudest of was making his mother a real character, you know, and Yami only shows up in a couple of stories. I think she only shows up on panel, like probably a handful of times. You know, I'm like, well, what impact did she have on his life, even in his absence, you know? And then Ta-Nehisi picks up on that and uses it kind of as a basis for like the whole intergalactic Empire of Wakanda story. So I was really happy about that. So, you know, in Rise, I want to kind of show the different facets of T'Challa's personality as, you know, has been kind of like bought up in his publishing history. So like, you know, he's a compassionate dude in the McGregor run. He's kind of manipulative in the first Lee Kirby appearances. He's, you know, goofy and adventurous in the Kirby stuff, you know, and just show all those different parts of his personality. So, you know, he's like, he's kind of talking shit when he's fighting Bucky and doing science experiments. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm like, yeah, like this to me, this fits. This is, this is a character that can hold all these different interpretations. So contrast that with Miles, whose publishing history is, you know, I don't even think he's hit a 10-year anniversary yet. So but at the same time, this character has been vaulted to, you know, a level of popularity thanks to the movie that is up there with, you know, the highest kind of most well-known Marvel characters, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, when we were working on the game, it was very much an opportunity to create a new iteration of the character, right? Which, you know, leans on the publishing history, but also we can take things in a little different direction, right? Obviously, Insomniac did the Peter Parker game, and by virtue of that and the events of that game, spoiler alert, specifically with Miles's dad dying, you know, it's going to be a different kind of tone, right? There's going to be more mournfulness, more grief, you know? But also, you know, moving him to a new neighborhood, thinks about, you can tell a different story there. So, you know, we were very conscious of the fact that, you know, the movie catapulted Miles to a level of popularity and recognition that, you know, a lot of characters don't reach, and that the game was going to be the second entry, kind of like the second major kind of adaptation for people who don't read the comics to encounter this character. Right. So, you know,
Right.
Obviously, we didn't want to repeat, you know, the work that Chris Miller and Phil Lord had done. Did I transpose their names? Oh, man. Anyway, Lord and Miller. Let's just keep sticking with last names. But
I do the same thing.
We didn't want to repeat, you know, and Peter Ramsey and everybody else who worked on that movie. Mm-hmm. We didn't want to repeat any of those beats, right? So, because when you're doing a new adaptation, you want it to feel like fresh and have its own take. And so when we were thinking about the major plot beats for the game, obviously you can go in a different direction with the villain. You can go in a different direction with some of the family dynamics. You know, we can have Genki be a major part of the game, right? And focus on their relationship more. And, you know, interrogate the idea of stepping into this amazing, that was kind of an unintended word choice, but I'm going to lean into it.
Yeah.
Into stepping into this amazing heroic legacy and trying to make it his own, you know, which is, you know, a lot of what the movie's about, but the game is different because he's not doing it in partnership with Peter or in contrast to Peter. With Peter as a foil, he's doing it on his own. So, you know, again, the commentary from some of the NPC characters does remark on the fact that, oh, yeah, you know, the Spider Kid, whatever. He's like, the people treat him like second rate, you know?
Right.
But
he's not the OG.
Yeah, he's not the OG. And but also, like, you know, being able to put forth these ideas that, like, yeah, in a lot of ways, Miles is cooler than Peter. And that's something I've been saying ever since my first meetings with Insomniac. And it's not, you know, just because, like, he's a young black man. It's because, like, our ideas of what teenagers are different than what they were in the 1960s when Peter Parker was created. So, you know, adults know more about teenagers now than they did back then. And teenagers influence popular culture, for everything from like streetwear, sneakers, fashion, you know, but also like social media. You know, teenagers are a force in mainstream culture in a lot of ways. And so when you think about a character like Miles who's a teenager, you know, you want to tap into that. That's very much what we tried to do.
The first Spider-Man game was obviously a massive hit. It was up for Game of the Year. And as you mentioned, some of the Miles storylines were already planted in that first game. You're introduced to Miles, you learn about his dad, etc. Did you feel any kind of pressure in having to follow it up with him or not?
Yeah, I mean, you know, one thing I should say about the Miles game was that, like, all the writing, you know, video game writing is a team effort. It was Ben Arfin, who was the lead writer. Mary Kenny was also a writer in the game. And myself was brought in as a consultant. So the pressure, yeah, was there, you know? Like, I've always liked Miles as a character. You know, I remember when I was still on the journalist side of things and Marvel and Sony had struck their deal to kind of be able to use Spider-Man in the Marvel movies. And I wrote an article, I think it was, I was still at Kotaku at the time, that was like, you know, the next on-screen Spider-Man should be, you know, this guy, you know, like we've had three Peter Parkers and that's great. And I love Tom Holland, but, you know, like Miles is right there. So yeah, all that to say is, like, yes, we're aware of the pressure and what most people like think about when they hear Spider-Man, they think about Peter first. You know, you can't run away from that reality, but like Miles has his own branch of, you know, again, that heroic legacy now that is different and has a different energy to Peter. So yeah, we were aware of the pressure, you know, and I think one of the things that's, you know, our proudest accomplishment with the Miles game is, like, you know, there's that nickname for Peter, like Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man, right? But, you know, I can only speak as a kid who was growing up reading Spider-Man comics. It never felt like Peter was from Queens. It felt like Peter was from Manhattan, you know, like that's where all his adventures took place, you know. And granted, if you know anything about Queens, it's not the best place for web swinging, right? Only small sections with skyscrapers and less hustle and bustle, less banks to rob. Or less banks to stop from being robbed. Let's not get all Jameson up in here. So one of the things I feel like we're most proud of what happened with Miles was that like he felt connected to his neighborhood, you know,
and that made it Harlem focused. That was so good.
And that was one of the things we wanted to do almost from the outset, you know, was like, okay, not only is he having to step into like the varsity squad of superheroing, right? Mm-hmm. He also has to figure out, this is part of the whole part of the city, which I don't really know that well, but now I have to figure out how to call home. And they're skeptical about him. And figuring out, okay, how do you create a sense of belonging for this character in this place? So all that to say, yes, the pressure was very felt and very, very much, you know, a motivator and component of the energy, the creative energy that we tried to bring to the game.
Well, you guys delivered, first of all, and this is not really a question, but just because I don't get this opportunity very often, let me just shower you and your team with praise for a second. We both loved the game, but all the things you said, I was going to bring up. I love that you made it neighborhood focused. I love that you brought his mother into the fold. But I think in general, Robbie and I both love that you and the entire team made him feel different than Peter in how he played, even how he swings is more loose. It's freer. Yeah. Like you brought up the neighborhood focus. Like the very first scene when you start the game is he walks up the subway into his neighborhood and he's interacting with all his friends and like there, it just, you guys delivered on all that stuff. So I loved it. I love how different you made him feel, and you made it somehow be able to coexist with Peter Parker when it already had that pressure of Peter Parker kind of owning that whole space. So congrats.
Thank you. You know, it's funny that you mentioned that first scene. A friend of mine just started playing the game, and they were like, "Oh my god, that scene!
It's so cool."
And you know, like it's very much like one of the things I miss about New York City. I was born and raised there. I've lived in Austin for the last couple of years now, and you know, there's a part of growing up in New York City where you get on the subway, and yeah, you know, you have the directions. Somebody tells you, okay, when you get out of this stop. Mm-hmm. You're going to make a left or you're going to go to the street, whatever. But you get up, you walk up those stairs, and you're a new part of this living, breathing ecosystem that you've never explored before. So like when Miles comes up out of the subway, you're looking around. I remember being a teenager, you know, even into college, being like, okay, when I first really got let loose to move around the city by myself, as nervous as my mom was, like, it was like, wow, I'm in Harlem now. I remember the first time I went to Harlem. Like I was in by myself. I was in college, and my mom had a friend of hers who was going to Haiti, and she was like, "Okay, I want you to send this to take this thing to my friend so they can, you know, bring it back to some people back home." And I was like, "Oh, I'll never forget my first time like walking across Morningside Park and being like, and then like walking past Columbia University. It's like, oh, I've never been here. There's like a whole history." And neighborhood vibe and culture that I, you know, had only really read about, maybe even. Mm. And like, you're like, oh, wow, this is where like James Baldwin lived. This is where, you know, jazz was created, you know, or at least bebop. You know, it's all that stuff is just a train stop away, you know, and being a teenager and having the agency to explore that stuff in New York City is an amazing experience, and you know, helped make me who I am. And like, yes, I wanted us to get some of that in the game, and I think, you know, I'm happy with how we executed, and a lot of other people are, but that was part of it, you know, like you know, East Harlem specifically has a super intense vibe. It's like a great epicenter of cultural exchange, you know, people from, you know, Latinx Caribbean communities and Black Caribbean communities, and even African continental communities are up there. Like Harlem is just like this epicenter for like so much of like the cultural and artistic energy of New York City. So like we want to reflect that too. And of course it's like a Marvel Games universe. I don't even know if that's the term they're actually using. Sorry, Bill and Eric. But but it's so it's a heightened version. It's a fictional version, right? But like that just gives it more opportunity to like make it like big and metaphorical and bold. You know, like there's not a mural on every street in real world Harlem, but we can sure as hell put one in fictional Insomniac Games Harlem. You know, and that makes it feel like, again, a real love letter to the cultures that actually exist there. So, you know, that's what we want to do.
Well, and just to add, I loved it so much because Harlem, as you know, in the first game is kind of the left out area. Like you don't go there that often. Yeah. And so there was like this,
the
there
tombstones, was this space. The tombstone missions are the only things that kind of happen specifically in that neighborhood.
Yep. And so there was this space. And then for you guys to give it the color, and you talked about jazz, like to have Uncle Aaron have the music background with this dialogue about his dad and, you know, and the little music memos. And then I think another look underrated thing is that this is the first game I can remember that didn't have cutscenes. You know, like the whole thing flows. There's no loading screens is what I mean by that. And so maybe that doesn't affect you as a writer, but what ends up coming out is a really smooth story, even from, like we said, the way he walks out of the first subway into the first village. But even the way he comes out of his house and gets into his Spider-Man outfit is so smooth, right into the music, right into like, so you just feel so immersed in Harlem and Miles as a character.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like Spider-Man adjacent characters, you know, spider heroes, for lack of a better term, you know, they want movement and action, and, you know, they want to feel like connected to like the energy of their spaces. Right. And I think that's part of what informed all the creative decisions that the team considered, you know, like Kyle was talking about the web swinging animations, like, you know, all credit to James Hamm, one of the animators who worked on the game, who was like, you know, yeah, he thought about like, okay, what if this young kid got superpowers and has been learning how to swing throughout the city, like how does that become a mode of personal expression for him? Right. You know, you think about like, you know, something like skateboarding, right? Professional skateboarding, like the tricks certain skateboarders use like differ according to their personality, right? Like, so, you know, somebody's going to do more kickflips. Somebody's going to do more grabs, you know, somebody's going to be better at vert or grinding rails, you know, like they don't all try to do the same things. They all be like, okay, what is it within my skill set and capability to do? And they do that. And we thought about web swinging and Miles the same way. And James certainly did, you know, I can't take any credit for that. That's him and the animation team.
That's, I mean, that is one of the things that I immediately noticed. And yeah, Cal and I have talked about that a good bit. I think the way that you, not just the way that you put a stamp on Miles and the way that he feels and the way that he talks, that's, you know, in line, I think, with his earliest iterations, but also evolving in some interesting and I think some positive ways. You also did some really interesting work, again, with kind of the not just Miles mythos, but Spider-Man mythos in general. Like I thought it was really interesting sort of taking the Tinkerer and using that character in such a way that I don't think there's any real precedent for.
Yeah. You know, thinking about the Tinkerer and like, again, one of, I think, the great successes of the preceding Spider-Man game with Peter was like, reimagining these characters' relationships to each other, you know? So like the whole time you're playing that first Spider-Man game, you're like, okay, Otto Octavius, I know what's going to happen. Is it actually going to happen? And that tension of the new interpretation is found mostly in them being friends, the mentor relationship, you know, like you can even say like avuncular or paternal, you know, like he's like an uncle or surrogate father to Peter. And then you take that tension and you're like, okay, well, I know the canon from the comics and are they going to do it here? To see it actually happen the way they do it there, like Brian Intihar and John Paquette and Ben Arfman and everybody who worked on that game from narrative perspective, like just delivered such like a gut punch when that finally happens. And like,
right.
Which not to say that there's a template that we followed from Miles, but it's like, okay, well, we wanted this game to be about family in a way that you really can't do with Peter, because again, all Peter really has is Aunt May. And, you know, you have grief that's a lot more fresh for Miles. You have his mother trying to kind of reconfigure her life in response to that loss and that grief. And you have him moving to a new neighborhood. Okay, so what if somebody shows up in his life that hasn't been around, you know? And what if she's had her own grief to deal with and it's taken her in a different direction? So, you know, while there is like that kind of like close familial similarity between like Miles and Finn and Peter and Otto, like it's different because we see them going from different directions after suffering their own traumas. You know, and the fact that the Tinkerer is a character that's relatively obscure and, you know, most people only know, if they knew the character at all, it was like this old dude from who's a kind of a riff on the mad scientist trope from the old comics. Completely turn that on its ear, you know? Again, that's, you know, all credit to the other folks who worked on the game, like Ben and Mary and Brian Horton, the creative director. You know, and, you know, when I came in, it was like, all right, well, what do you do when your kids growing up together? You know, like you go to school together, you do science fairs, you do little projects, you run around, get in trouble. Like people around the neighborhood know you, especially if you're like smart or, you know, one of the ideas that's kind of implicit in the collectible side quest is like these kids were like mini celebrities, right? Because they're clearly geniuses, you know? And they were making rocket powered skates, which was, you know, a nod at Rocket Racer, a classic Spider-Man villain, and other stuff. Like they share that bond by virtue of being, you know, these young, ambitious, smart kids who like seemingly have the world just waiting for them to kind of enter into it. But when they do enter into the world, it's, you know, under the cloud of grief and loss and figuring out what to do with that. They come of age in some very challenging ways.
And, you know, I feel like what's incredible about that is how in a relatively short game, you know, compared to when you look at games like The Last of Us or something that are kind of emotional and a good bit longer, you delivered such a kind of emotional gut punch. And immediately, I mean, the reason I bring up the Tinkerer is, like I said, kind of invented a whole new take on a character that now I really cared about and, you know, really hit home in an unsettling, but really like true to a Spider-Man way, you know, in the way that like where that leaves Miles and kind of the I think what he's left considering, you know, in the aftermath of her choice there at the end. And I thought it was, I mean, just in general to echo Kyle and shower you with praise, both of these works, you know, I've really enjoyed, and I do want folks that are listening, that haven't gotten to check out Rise of the Black Panther or the Miles Morales game to do so. And we'll talk more about that, in the coming weeks. I wanted to take one moment before we let you go and see, is there anything you're working on right now that you can tell us about, anything you're excited about?
Yeah. Twitter is, my handle is FNARC, you know, at EVNARC. Let's see, what can I talk about? Well, my friend, my road dog, my brother, Austin Walker, and I, we co-wrote a New Day comic for Boom Studios, which is basically the in-universe, the in-fiction origin story of how Kofi and Big E and Austin all got together to form the tag team, and it was a lot of fun.
Oh, wow.
It's so like close to my heart, like figuring out that story and riffing on it and working on it with Austin. I have to say his last name Walker, so people don't think I mean Creed. but yeah, figuring that out was so much fun. So that comes out in July. You'll be able to find that wherever you buy your comics digitally or in a store, please support your local comic stores, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Austin Books and Comics.
Exactly. I'm a Dragon's Lair dude, but it's all good. There's no beef. They're just closer. They're my local.
That's fair. Same.
So that's coming out. Genlock season two. There's just a little bit of a teaser that just hit. Genlock, for those who don't know, is a science fiction mecha series from Rooster Teeth. I was a consultant on the first season and a full staff writer on season two. And there's a little bit of a teaser that just dropped. Michael B. Jordan voices the main character of Julian Chase. It's got a great cast that includes Maisie Williams, David Tennant. Who am I forgetting? Other people I can't even remember right now. Miles Luna's up in there. What up, Miles? Hmm. In season two is coming soon. I don't know the exact date, so don't at me. but it's going to be incredible. We told a story that I think is really ambitious. So, we really try to think about, okay, there's a war where giant robots are fighting. And what does it mean when this technology kind of proliferates? What does it mean politically when the world is in the churn of such intense change by virtue of technological developments? How does that change the capabilities, rather the possibilities for like human cognition? And that's probably all I should say. but that's coming soon. I don't know when, don't ask me, but
wow,
there's a little bit of a teaser.
What a tease.
There's a little bit of a teaser that Michael B. Jordan posted on his Instagram account. And people seem to like it there. So, so that's what I have coming out. A bunch of other stuff I can't talk about. Some things that might be announced soon, but, I am very busy right now.
Well, yeah, no, that's awesome. It's fun to, for us to have stuff to be looking forward to then. Well, thank you so much, Evan, for coming on. This has been a ton of fun and know, you know, that there's a standing invitation. If you ever want to come back and get your, you know, MCU talk fix.
Yeah.
I hope that we'll be your first stop.
Thank you guys for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks.
All right. Take care.
Thanks so much to Evan for coming on our show and doing that. We had a blast talking to him. If you haven't read Rise of the Black Panther, go get it. I'm sure you can get it anywhere comics are found. I think you'll really enjoy it. And if you're a video game player at all, get Miles Morales on PS5. It's so much fun. It's a fun follow-up to the first Spider-Man, and I think you'll really, truly enjoy that. My passion on that episode is not faked. I really, really like that game. So go play it. Thanks again for listening, guys. Don't forget you can message us at the FFW Podcast, and we have a fun announcement coming Monday regarding that stuff. Rate, review, subscribe to wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on social media at the FFW Podcast. And then we'll see you next Monday on Friends from Work.
The search for truth never ends. Introducing June's Journey, a hidden object mobile game with a captivating story. Connect with friends, explore the roaring 20s, and enjoy thrilling activities and challenges while supporting environmental causes. After 7 years, the adventure continues with our immersive travels feature. Explore distant cultures and engage in exciting experiences. There's always something new to discover. Are you ready? Download June's Journey now on Android or iOS.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. It prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.